Hello everyone and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. My name is David Chen. I've never read any of the books in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
My name is Joanna Robinson. I've read every book in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And thank you for listening, guys. If you're just tuning in for the first time, you can find more of our episodes at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. You can also email us and let us know what you think of the podcast and of the show Game of Thrones at acastofkings@gmail.com. I want to point out that we will spoil everything through this week's episode of Game of Thrones, and that includes, in this case, everything through Season 3, Episode 4, entitled And Now His Watch Is Ended. We will not be spoiling anything from future week's episode of Game of Thrones, and that includes anything in the next time on spoilers or previews that HBO usually airs. And I point out that we treat this primarily as a television show, and even though Joanna's read the books, we will not be going into any future plot developments. But on that note, Joanna Robinson, we expect that at slashfilm.com, where this podcast is hosted, that none of the comments contain spoilers for future episodes. And that, we've had to delete comments for people that spoil things in the past. So please keep spoilers off the comments. But John Robinson, we've been noticing a pretty interesting phenomenon, haven't we? As we're, like, now that we've watched this episode this week, we can talk about the fact that some of these predictions, quote-unquote, that people have posted at slashfilm.com are remarkably accurate as to what actually happened in the show. Would you say that's correct?
I would, and in the book,
And we're not saying that you guys read the books and then just told us what happens in them to spoil things for people. We're not making that accusation, but I will say that our eyebrows have been raised, and that if certain people on the comment boards continue commenting saying, oh, I haven't read the books, but I'm pretty sure this is going to happen, and it's exactly what happens, and that continues week to week, I don't know. We may take some corrective action against that.
Just don't do it, guys. There's no point in it.
I don't think there's a problem with people actually predicting things.
No, of course not. Yeah.
But if you I think the issue is, like, if you know what happens and then you put it out there as, like, in the guise of a prediction, and it, you know, that's not true. But how do you distinguish between the two? That is very difficult. We will use our judgment, but yeah, if you get every single fact right every single week, it's going to be pretty clear who is actually predicting and who is,
So what Dave's trying to say is throw in a few wrong predictions in there.
Yeah.
And we won't be able to tell.
That's right. Throw us off the scent and it'll be fine.
And I also, this is not shameless self-promotion. I do want to say that I'm doing an article every week over on Pajiba that's called the Spoiler Horror and Book Reader Edition Recap. And that means you can spoil anything you want to in the comments. It's one of the few places on the internet, other than, like, dedicated message boards, where you can spoil the crap out of all the books you've read or any predictions you want and that sort of stuff. So if you need an outlet, if you're just, like, dying and you need to talk about it, those go up on Wednesday on Pajiba.com. So
yeah, so check that out. And that's not a shameless promotion, Joanna. That's more of a shameful promotion.
There you go. There you go.
All right, a couple of other announcements this week. First of all, is people still writing in about the iOS app, the podcast app, and not being able to access the show? We do have somewhat of a fix for that. Apparently, like, the subscription for iOS is kind of wonky. If you just unsubscribe from the podcast in the iOS podcast app and just go to the store and download it directly from the store, I think you need to be connected to Wi-Fi for that to work. You should have no problems accessing the show. So, again, deepest apologies for anyone who's had problems with this. The podcast is still available at Stitcher and on Downcast app, easily downloaded. And of course, you can always just go to GameOfThronesPodcast.com and listen to it there as well. So sorry about the problems with that app, but you should be able to download it. Just go straight to the store and download it from there. That should solve your issues. Finally, Joanna Robinson, we've been spoiling people, haven't we, Joanna? We've been spoiling them with really, really timely episodes. And by that, I mean, like, the episode of Game of Thrones airs, and by the next morning, you are able to download and listen to Cast of Kings. And unfortunately, that is not going to be the case going forward. The circumstances that have allowed us to do this, like, scheduling-wise, are just not going to be the same from here on out. Specifically next week, I know My family's going to be in town over the weekend and on Monday and Tuesday, so I'm just not going to be able to record the podcast until maybe like Wednesday or Thursday of next week. But I think like the sort of commitment that we made is that the Cast of Kings episode will be released before the next episode of Game of Thrones airs, right? And I think we can, with almost no exception, I'm pretty sure we're going to be able to maintain that commitment through the rest of the season. So best case scenario, we're hoping to get the podcast out like Monday or Tuesday. Next week in particular, it's going to come a little bit later. But for the rest of the season, hopefully episodes, you know, a day or two after the show airs. So, but yeah, I follow TV podcasts as well. I know what it's like to be able to mainline a podcast right after the episode has aired. So we're very sensitive to try to get these out in a timely fashion. So anyway, thank you guys for writing in at castofkings@gmail.com for all of your support for that. All right. Jonah Robinson, on occasion, we make errors during this podcast. I know it's shocking.
Never. Certainly not on a weekly basis.
Certainly not on a weekly basis. Well, there is one error we need to correct. And that is that last week, Jonah Robinson mentioned that or opined that the reason why the slave on the Walk of Punishment turned away water was because of some sense of duty, when in fact, later on in the episode, Missandei, what's her name again?
Missandei
explained that it's because he wants to die because he can't be a slave in death. So just wanted to make that – got a few letters about that. Just want to make that clear that that was the reason. Although I think Jonah's interpretation is not – entirely without merit, but
I mean, it's wrong.
It's wrong, you know.
Dave, it's funny. Dave put in like a clip from the show into the podcast and like after we had finished recording, yeah. And he warned me. He's like, basically it contradicts what you said. So
that was my subtle way of upstaging and subverting Joanna's comments. So you're welcome. You're welcome to both Joanna and the people listening. So, all right, guys. So let's talk about this week's episode, which is entitled "And Now His Watch Is Ended." And let's just say right off the bat, Joanna, this is a humdinger of an episode. Like, this is probably one of the best episodes of Game of Thrones I've ever seen. Right?
Dandy.
In terms of in terms of action that has taken place during this episode, performances, like the plot stuff, everything is firing on all cylinders during this episode, with one exception, and I'm going to get to that in a little bit.
Yeah, and that's going to be dangerous for us.
Yeah,
to
yeah. Well, not for me, but in any case, let's get into this week's episode. So, we begin like shortly after last episode left off with the Jaime and Brienne storyline, and apparently Jaime has a hand around his neck. Like they've taken his hand and they've hung it around his neck. I guess it's a kind of way to remind him of his disfigurement, right? Is that?
Yeah, to embarrass and shame him, for yeah. sure.
So so then this is kind of one of the few scenes in the show where I actually felt bad for Jaime Lannister, not only because of the hand around his neck, but because they essentially torture him afterwards. They beat him. He tries to fight with his left hand, and you can see it's not as effective, right? I wonder if he had had both hands, if he would have actually been able to subdue all those men, right?
Yeah.
It seems
cut,
like
and cut Brienne. I think he and Brienne could have taken it.
Right. For sure. So one of the interesting parts about this was he asks for water and then the guy, what's his name?
Locke.
Yeah. Hands him a bottle of horse piss. And my question is, did this guy just have horse piss like laying around in a bottle just in general, or was he specifically planning on pranking Jaime?
Oh my God, who doesn't have a bottle of horse piss lying around?
Is that a Westeros convention that you just have horse piss for general purposes, or
y'all don't do that in Seattle?
No, we don't. Unfortunately, that's just kind of weird. I just thought it was a little weird, Joanna.
I think it was for a prank. It was for laughs.
For kicks.
For funsies,
just
yeah.
For funsies, yeah. They're just going to – at some point, Jamie's going to be so thirsty, and then we're going to give him horse piss. It's going to be hilarious.
Guys, hilarious.
Those guys are such jokesters. So anyway, what did you think of this opening scene, Joanna?
I thought it was great. One thing that the book does so effectively is make you feel for Jaime Lannister. And I think I mentioned that before. I think it has a lot to do with him being a point of view character. So you're inside his head and you get, I mean, once again, we can't forget that he pushed a kid out of a tower and bones his sister. But, you know, you
like, pushed a kid out of a tower, bones his sister, like killed all of Ned's men, killed his former squire, right? Right, the Lannister guy in the cage.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, he's done a bunch of really crappy, inhumane stuff. So the fact that the show makes you feel sympathy for this character is pretty skillful, right?
Yeah, and yeah. So he's brought so low here, and you see him covered in mud, and there's that great shot where he's like just in the mud, and it's his face, and then like his poor hand like right up next to his face, and it's super disgusting, and yeah. I thought they did a great job, you know. The performances are really good too, from everyone concerned. So
I do wonder, like, if they're going to take into account the increasing decompositional state of the hand, right? Like, because you know, body parts decompose really rapidly when they're not attached to anymore. So I'm curious if they're going to take that into account, or if they're going to fake it. You know?
Well, you know, Davos wears his finger bones around his neck. So
yeah, but those are bones, though.
No, I know.
Yeah,
I just think it's a cool little like echo of Davos's finger bones and Jaime's hand around his neck. So
later on, Jaime and Brienne are chatting, and Brienne reveals that she knows what Jaime did for her. She yells at him, right, for being kind of a pussy, right? She yells at him like, "You sound like a bloody woman."
What are you doing?
I'm dying.
You can't die. You need to live. To take revenge.
I don't care about revenge.
You coward. Your misfortune, you're giving up.
Misfortune.
You lost your hand.
My sword hand. I was that hand.
You have a taste. One taste of the real world. Where people have important things taken from them. And you whine and cry and quit. You sound like a bloody woman.
Yeah.
What did you think of that statement? Like, I thought it was hilarious and awesome. But I thought it was interesting that Brienne, who kind of has fought against female stereotypes, literally fought against female stereotypes her whole – I shouldn't say that literally, but like has literally fought ... against female stereotypes, it was kind of invoking a female stereotype.
You know, it's actually something that gets brought up several times in this episode, and we can talk about it some more, but I thought it was an interesting little bell that they decided to ring this one episode. They found this unifying theme of like gender roles, and they asked before, it was like when Brienne and Jaime, I think it was last episode, when she asked him, she's like, if you were a woman and they were going to rape you, what would you do, you know? And so it's this thing that sort of keeps popping up in their dynamic, you know, because she is so masculine and he is so powerless in this scenario. I didn't get offended or anything,
I just thought it was interesting because this whole she seems like the last person on the show that would say something like that. But I guess she's appealing to his kind of way of understanding the world, right?
Like, I don't think she even sees herself as a woman, though. Really, you know, she always gets upset when people call her a lady or whatever. She's like, I'm just Brienne. I am a knight. You know, I'm not a lady. So, you know, I'm not talking about any sort of like LGBTQIA issues or whatever. Like, she knows that she has lady parts, and I think she was in love with Renly. But, you know, I don't think she even thinks of herself as a lady. And I think she thinks of herself as a knight, and there are gender roles, even if she doesn't consider herself beholden to them.
Right. But you know, my point being that, like, even if she did subscribe to gender roles, which, you know, she may or may not, right? She's kind of making an appeal to Jaime's way of understanding things. Like, she knows that's going to get a rise out of him. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
And so she was doing that effectively. It's also kind of interesting, the dynamic of what she's saying, that she's inciting him to get revenge on the Starks men, right? Who theoretically are on the same side as Catelyn, even though Catelyn is now branded a traitor, right?
Yeah, but Brienne has said this whole time that she doesn't serve the Starks, she serves Catelyn, right. Like only Catelyn. And they tried to rape her. So
right. So, so you know. Yeah, that's true. So then she reveals that you know, she knows what he did for her, which is lie about the Sapphire Isle to get, you know, to kind of help her out.
To save her virtue.
To save her virtue. And it's I thought there were a couple of interesting things about that. First of all, this episode does that thing that they sometimes do in TV shows where just when a really interesting moment has occurred or a question has been asked, they cut away to like a totally different scene and you never get to see how that's resolved. Like, what was his answer? Maybe it was a rhetorical question. You know, and I do wonder, what is the answer to that question? Now, Jonah, I'm guessing you know the answer or more about it is revealed in later book stuff. So I don't know how much you can speak to it. But my, you know, I would postulate that she has earned Jamie's grudging respect through their interactions together, right?
I think that's accurate.
And from kicking her ass. I'm sorry, from kicking his ass. And like she saw her take down those like three dudes. So even though he mocks her relentlessly, he kind of still respects her and admires her, and that's really hard for Jamie to admit explicitly. But one way he does communicate it is by kind of saving her. So I thought it was just a fantastic moment. Now,
which is pretty sweet for a child killer, right?
Yeah. Well, child attempted murderer.
incestuous attempted child killer.
They don't give awards for attempted. They don't give Nobel Prizes for attempted chemistry, Joanna. Just putting that out there. So the other thing that I thought was interesting was, what was that conversation like when someone revealed to Brienne that she knows what he did for her? Like, you know, did someone say, hey, by the way, that Jamie guy said, here's the plan. Jamie told us XYZ, and so we're doing XYZ. Do you know what I mean?
She couldn't have heard him say that. That's true.
So I just thought that must have been a funny conversation. Like,
hilarious.
Hilarious. It was not in the show, but... I was just curious, how did she learn that information? So anyway, so pretty great continuation of the Jamie and Brienne storyline. I'm very curious to see where it goes and how their friendship ? Continues to develop. This week we also got a little bit more from King's Landing. So we had this very interesting scene with Tyrion and Varys.
There was so much good Varys this episode.
Very good Varys. A lot of good Varys. So Varys describes how he was castrated, and it's a really horrifying, graphic story. And it also explains his aversion to magic, right? Because he was castrated by a sorcerer who cut him and burned him. And
well, a priest.
A
red priest who's like, so like a Melisandre.
A Melisandre,
right. The same religion as Melisandre.
Right. And... you just get to find out so much more of Varys' backstory, which is like all horrifying, right? Not only his castration, but also like he describes having sold himself.
Yeah, like himself. Yeah,
the parts of him that were left,
right?
To sort of climb his way up to, and now he's, you know, in the small council. Like, he went from a castrated boy in the streets to now he's kind of helping to run things in this kingdom. And it's a remarkable scene. What did you think of this scene, Joanna?
But influence is largely a matter of patience, I have found. Once I had served the sorcerer's purpose, he threw me out of his house to die. I resolved to live. To spite him, I begged. I sold what parts of my body remained to me. I became an excellent thief and soon learned that the contents of a man's letters are more valuable than the contents of his purse. Step by step, one distasteful task after another, I made my way from the slums of Mere to the small council chamber. Influence grows like a weed. I tended mine patiently until its tendrils reached from the Red Keep all the way across to the far side of the world, where I managed to wrap them around something very special.
God, I loved it. I thought it was great. That story actually happens in the previous book. So he starts to tell it. If you watch the episode Blackwater, I rewatched.
Right. Yeah. No, he says, I never told you why I was cut. And then right. He's like, maybe I'll tell you one day. And I'm glad they actually followed it up. He actually does tell him.
Exactly. And, you know, I think both he, and then the business with the box is not from the book at all. But it was like giving him something to do while he's telling this horrible story. And then the reveal was, of course, terrifying and horrific. And,
it's very interesting how the show chooses to have because a lot of the show is just people telling stories to each other, but they are in the process of doing things while they're telling these stories, and the things that they're doing communicate a little bit about the character. In this case, there's a big reveal, but obviously Tywin, he's always doing some kind of business while he's...
Oh, no, he's like butchering an animal. He's writing some letters.
Writing letters. He really likes to write a lot of letters.
He's a multitasker.
He has like a lot of pen pals, I think, is what really... so I was actually a little confused, Joanna, at first, which I know is shocking to people listening. But at first I thought that it was Pyat Pree in the box. For the reason that... the dude in the box looked pretty disfigured and burned. Was I accurate in seeing that, or was my TV on a too dark of a setting?
It was pretty dark. I agree that shot, but he was burnt, and or you know, like his mouth was sewn shut. I was not quite sure. Something very disfiguring was going on in his face.
Yeah, yeah.
But so Pyat Pree is a warlock. And whoever this is, he's a red priest. So different religions.
Totally different class. I was totally off. But I just didn't know, was that some crazy Dickensian coincidence that's Pyat Pree? And we also did see Pyat Pree get really badly burned last season. Maybe he somehow survived.
Very badly burned. Yes.
Yeah. So, but that's not Pyat Pree at all. So my bad. And they also have this discussion about Tyrion trying to get revenge on the person who tried to kill him, which he thinks is his sister, right?
Right.
But he has no proof. He's trying to get
proof. I love Varys has a really snarky line reading, and he's like, evidence? Is there going to be a trial? Like, I just – Colmeth Hill is just the best as playing Lord Varys. He's so good.
He's very good. And he appears multiple times in this episode. One other thing I wanted to point out that I thought was awesome was while Varys is describing the story of how he rose through the ranks, they use Melisandre's theme in the music track, which is the first time that you see that theme used when it's not Melisandre or Stannis on screen.
That's interesting.
So it was kind of like, wow, it's a way to subtly evoke the Fire Gods and that whole storyline through the music of the show without, you know, because he's obviously referring to the Fire Gods, but you know, Melisandre is nowhere to be found in this episode anywhere, right? She's not in this episode. So it's kind of a way to kind of call up the specter of that whole plot line without actually showing it.
The musical themes are not something that we've talked about a lot, I think, but it wasn't until I was watching the Blu-ray of season 2 where they talked a lot about the Reigns of Castamere as the Lannister theme that they play a lot as the Lannister theme. And then I started paying attention. I'm not as attuned as you are to soundtracks. And so then I started really paying attention to those character themes that they play. So
yeah. So Melisandre's theme makes an appearance, and it's very creepy and very appropriate and well used. I also thought the point that he's trying to make was interesting. Like, the revenge you seek will be yours in time. He's kind of saying to Tyrion, if you're patient, like it took Varys apparently decades and decades to get his revenge.
Right.
So maybe he's saying that to Tyrion, like, if you wait, you will get your revenge on the person that tried to kill you. I'm hoping for our sake, like the viewer's sake, it doesn't take that long. But we'll see what happens. So then we got some more action here with the Night's Watch. And they kind of have gone back to Craster's den, and this was a really crazy plotline. So there's some nice color there with the Night's Watch kind of complaining about shoveling, and there was this pretty awesome funeral sequence, which is hilarious, right? The dialogue is like he came to us from where did he come from again? It kind of like that. Even though there's this kind of honor between these men of the Night's Watch, that they're still Mormont doesn't really know anything about them, right? That there's this kind of facelessness to them as well. What did you make of that funeral scene?
You know, I think they did a good job of showing the growing discontent. Like, I don't feel like what happens afterwards is out of character or surprising. And they did it rather quickly. You know, like the end of last week's episode, and then within this episode, you see all that anger and then come bubbling to the surface.
Right.
And of course, its themes carry over from last season when they were staying with Craster. Yeah, and then they said something about like, oh, I never thought he could smell so good because they're so hungry and his like body meat is cooking. But I didn't think it was meant to show Mormont as a bad leader. Like, I don't think they're ever. I don't think so either.
Yeah, I don't think so either. It just is a funny kind of way of of conveying. It also shows that like. Well, okay, first of all, let's explain, Joanna, who is the guy who's getting burned to death, like, in the funeral? Like, who is that guy? Bannon is his name.
He's a member of the Night's Watch.
Right.
Who had a wound on his foot.
And died from it, right? And where was he stationed again?
Where was he stationed?
Yeah. You said he was, like, he was stationed north of the Wall, correct? Or was he with them?
Like, he was with them at the Fist of the First Men. And then they came back, like, was wounded, came back, and he died because conditions are so poor at Craster's Keep that they're cold and they're starving.
I see.
And they're wounded. Like, the only reason they're there is, Mormont says, the only reason they're there is that he's waiting for all his wounded to be able to move to go back to the Wall. That's the only reason why they're staying at Craster's.
Right.
And the thesis that some of the Night's Watchmen have is that there's no way we're going to get better here. You know, the guy's not giving us any food and we're freezing. So.
Right, right. Got it. Okay. So bad things happen at Craster's Keep afterwards, right? This growing discontentment kind of bubbles to the surface. And here's the thing. I don't want to say I felt sympathy for Craster because he's obviously a monster. He's a hard character to like. Let's put that out there. But at the same time, like, does he owe anything to these Night's Watch people? He's just trying to, if he wasn't an incestuous pedophile, if he's just living, which I know kind of defines it, but let's say he wasn't, if he's just living out in the middle of the woods, is there any reason why, like, the Night's Watch should expect anything from him?
No.
Right. He's just kind of a dude living out there in the middle of nowhere that has some resources that the Night's Watch just feel like they have the right to take. Go ahead.
Well, I don't know. I think it speaks to hospitality and just sort of general. I mean, the Night's Watch, it's like supporting your troops. You know what I mean? The Night's Watch do this job. He lives north of the Wall, though. So, you know, it's a little different. But, like, the Night's Watch do this job, and they should be treated in a way for sacrificing their lives to protect, you know, the land.
Is there an equivalent of the Third Amendment in Westeros?
No.
Apparently not. Apparently not. That's why Craster needs to help these men. What were you going to say?
No, I mean, that's all. I mean, no, Craster has a point. Like, why should I give you all my food when we have to make it through the winter and I've got all my daughter wives to feed? But he's also disgusting and repugnant. So, you know, what are you going to do?
Therefore, worthy of death. So it wasn't surprising to me that Craster was killed. Like, that's not... I was like, okay, I mean, obviously he had it coming. There was lots of people pissed at him. The really, like, oh my gosh moment was when Mormont was killed, which I think was by Rast, right?
Yeah.
That's when this whole situation went from kind of being like a small mutiny to being like the thin blue line between order and chaos is dissolving, you know, that... If they're killing Mormont, then you really see, these are just criminals and rapists. There's nothing that is preventing them from just living out the law of the Wild Wild West here. It's just a genuinely terrifying moment when Mormont killed him. Who, by the way, was such a badass that he was still able to turn around and kind of try and... did he kill Rast? I think
No, he choked Rast and then Rast... And then he started, like, spitting blood and fell to the ground. And then Rast pounced on top of him and stabbed the shit out of him.
Yeah, so. That's right. That's right. Yeah. So just a really, really terrifying sequence. And then, of course, Sam escapes with Gilly and her boy. What did you think of the sequence? How did you feel it landed?
I thought it landed really well. I mean, it's a really rough scene in the book. And what I think I've talked before about how each book opens with like a cold open of a character. And the character that we get at the beginning of A Storm of Swords, this book, is plotting a mutiny. Like, the mutiny is in his mind from the beginning, and he has a bunch of men on his side, and then they're interrupted by the, you know, the others attacking, basically. And their mutiny is ruined. And then basically, you know, the plan is followed through later. But, you know, so that tension, it's such a big thing, that resentment of the Watch, that they are like a band. Like, there are some men who choose, but most men are rapists and criminals, and right. and they're put into this extreme situation, and Mormont is a good leader, but the situation is so scary and so rough for them that, you know, they just take him down. It's pretty sad. And I think something that isn't addressed a lot in the show, though people who, you know, I think they've addressed it once or twice, is that, you know, this is Jorah Mormont's father. So, like, there's that connection there of that other plot line that this is his father. And in the book, his dying wish is that, you know, to tell his son that he's sorry, which doesn't get brought up. I don't think they're really pushing the connection between those two, but,
right.
You know, that's something that has an extra resonance for book readers, is like that connection of different plot lines.
All right, Joanna. As people who are listening to this probably know, this podcast is only made possible by the generosity of people that supported us on Kickstarter. And we like to take a little bit of time out from each episode to thank all those people. Let's do that right now. This week, we want to thank Connor, who's the guy behind flickdrum.com. That's FlickDrum.com. Now, the movie industry is changing really rapidly these days. There was an article at IndieWire a couple weeks ago about how they think that film festivals should pay the films for, you know, kind of being – like if you submit a film to a Sundance Film Festival and you get in and Sundance sells like 5,000 tickets, you as a filmmaker don't see any of that money. And that's true for most film festivals. So this guy at IndieWire wrote this piece about how, oh, film festivals should pay money to the films that they're running. And then another article like chimed in and saying, no, that's not true. And so sort of the value of festivals brings is like something that's being hotly debated right now. So I thought the model for flickdrum.com, again, that's FlickDrum.com, was pretty interesting. It is an online, audience-decided, independent video festival, and it's ad-free with voters paying a small fee to watch and vote on video. But what's interesting here is the creator of the entry gets half the viewing fees, and the annual winner gets 10% of the total takings of the festival. So by removing all the overhead of a conventional film festival, they're able to give more money to the filmmakers, which is, again, I'm yet to see if this model will work on a wide scale, but it certainly is like it's kind of the direction it's going in. Film festivals have all this overhead, like you know, renting out the theaters and getting volunteers and making t-shirts and books and having a ticket selling apparatus. And if you turn all that to online, you can give more monies to filmmakers. So Flickdrum is a totally independent team in Australia that is sick of not being able to see independent content easily due to region restrictions. And there's also limited festival runs and a general lack of easy distribution channels for independent content that doesn't entirely rely on advertising. Flickdrum also doesn't demand rights over creator videos, so you're free to distribute them through Vimeo, YouTube, or whatever takes your fancy. They're currently in beta testing now, and if you are a video creator, you can go to flickdrum.com, that's flickdrum.com, FlickDrum.com, to sign up for the beta, and I think you have the option of kind of joining and maybe submitting your movie. So I know there's a lot of aspiring filmmakers out there. Joanna, in your experience at Pajiba, have you found a lot of aspiring filmmakers in your audience?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the advent of the internet and ways in which young filmmakers can get their stuff seen in new channels is one of the best things that technology has to offer. And so I'm really, really excited about the whole flickdrum.com idea and really happy that we can get the word out a little bit on this show.
Very cool. So flickdrum.com, that's FlickDrum.com. If you're a video maker, check it out. And someday soon, if you are someone who just loves movies, I'm sure they'll have a lot of interesting content for you guys to view. All right. In addition to flickdrum.com, we also got to thank all the individuals who backed us this week. Joanna, you want to start us off here?
I sure do. So we'd like to send a thank you. This is a part, by the way, in case you're new, where we bungle people's last name as best we can.
And some of their first names.
And sometimes their first names. So I want to thank David Breslin, Trevor Schowler, Vincent Montelione, Michael Hortant, Danielle Ingram Spriggs. It's Danielle, not Daniel. Travis Thompson, Matt Johnson, a.k.a. Big Damn Zero, Dave from Minneapolis, Roscoe Welch, and Andro Mastroioni. I'm so good at
those. Are pretty rough, Joanna. I'm looking at the pronunciation guide, and I think that you, that was a proper butchering. Let's just.
I know. Wait, should I do that again?
No, you're good. You're good. You're good. We'd also like to thank Kurt A., Eden Rabarch, Ankar Singh Gill, Kevin Jackson II, Christina Albright, Mike Gonzalez, Patrick Spinagle, Antti Ikonen from Finland, Brian Stone, and Bernardo Leita. Bernardo Leita. This pronunciation guide is useless, Joanna. I'm sorry.
Don't say that. Just say that we are the worst at reading names.
That's true.
Thank you guys so much for your donations.
Yes.
We really appreciate it. I hope you enjoyed having your name bungled on air by Joanna.
Yes. Yes. But seriously, guys, thanks so much. We really appreciate it. And apologies for not being able to pronounce your name correctly, even with a pronunciation guide. That's our bad. That's our bad. Okay. So let's move on, Joanna Robinson.
I'm ready.
What else happened in this episode?
I think we should talk about Bran's dream really quickly.
All right. Tell me about Bran's dream, because honestly, Joanna, I don't care that much about Bran's
dream. That's fine. That's what we can just talk about really quickly. Basically, Jojen's in the dream with Bran, so he's sort of guiding him, and then Bran gets kind of tossed out of a tree by Catelyn. So in case you were wondering whether or not Catelyn Stark is a bad person, she tossed her son out of a tree in his dream. I don't know. I think they're leaving the stuff in there, and that's good, so we can keep track of Bran. But I think you can't do dream after dream after dream on a TV show and make it super compelling.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And that's basically all, you know, Bran's done so far in the book. So
it's like a continuous cock tease of a dream. It's just like, can you pay this off, please? You know, like I'm getting rather tired. This has been going on for like 15 episodes already. You know,
right?
So anyway. Not particularly interested in Bran's storyline. I'm hoping something actually happens at some point.
It's just not amazing television.
Yeah.
I think it's great in the book, and it's just not. It's rough to do it on screen.
So then, I guess there are two weaknesses of this week's episode, then, Joanna. That was one of them.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So then, Roz and Varys have this discussion. Roz kind of serving her role as kind of spy for Varys,
and business manager of the
and
brothel.
Business manager out of nowhere, right?
right.
And apparently Lord Baelish has plans for Sansa, going to take her with him on this journey that he's doing.
Right.
So they have to put a stop to that. Let's return to that in a bit. But at King's Landing, other crazy stuff happened. Like Joffrey getting really boyishly excited about talking about dead people, which is pretty hilarious.
This is another really great example of how they do like some of the long history and exposition and stuff like that in an interesting way.
Right.
So he's like running around talking about all the dead Targaryens, which is, you know, just like a little filler of the Targaryen back history for Margaery there. So,
yeah. And just kind of I thought it's pretty hilarious how excited he was.
I mean, who doesn't get an enormous boner when they're talking about people been eaten by dragons?
Very few people. And then she kind of takes him out onto the Sept, right?
The steps of the Sept, yeah.
Steps of the Sept. And they do this waving thing. And at first, I did not know where that scene was going because I thought it would be a situation where they all cried out their love for Margaery. And then he saw that and then got really pissed. But apparently, right. Like, I heard people saying King Joffrey is cool too, right? Like,
yeah,
they were saying Boo-erns, basically, and they actually were saying Boo-erns in this case. And so I thought that was kind of interesting, like, because they hated Joffrey before, but I get, because on this show it can seem claustrophobic sometimes. You don't get a good sense of what the townspeople in King's Landing actually believe. And apparently they actually did believe that Joffrey helped them lead the defense against Blackwater. Is that correct?
Well, I think what it's meant to show is that Margaery has done some good PR work for him by going out and talking to, like, all the orphan children and whomsoever. And then, like, if you remember that scene from a couple episodes ago, she's like, King Joffrey's good, and he did this for you. Like, she's the PR machine.
Right.
Whereas, like, Cersei's approach has just been, like, they should cower and fear us, for we are Lannisters and we are above them. You know what I mean? But Margaery is a much better politician. And so it's meant to show how she's rehabilitated his image, you know, because he got, like, horse manure thrown at him last season,
right,
by people because they were starving. So she's rehabilitated his image, and it's meant to show her influence and what a good politician she is. So,
And Cersei has that look where she's kind of very concerned about what's going on. This woman has her claws in his son, and so she tries to bring this up with Tywin later on.
Cersei's super pissed.
She is really jealous and pissed and kind of angry about it, and so she goes to Tywin and is like, look, I'm sick of the Tyrells, blah blah blah. She's manipulating him, and they have this amazing scene of dialogue where Tywin, I feel like, is functioning kind of as the audience surrogate in this scene, right?
Yeah.
Where he's saying, I don't dislike you because you're a woman. I dislike you because you're not as smart as you think you are. And yeah, like, Cersei, I think, fashions herself as a brilliant, manipulative, cunning genius, but in fact has been highly ineffectual at getting things done, like preventing Ned from getting his head cut off.
Margaery has her claws in Joffrey. She knows how to manipulate him.
Good. I wish you knew how to manipulate him. I don't distrust you because you're a woman. I distrust you because you're not as smart as you think you are. You've allowed that boy to ride roughshod over you and everyone else in this city.
Perhaps you should try stopping him from doing what he likes.
I will.
I don't know about highly ineffectual. Did get her, like, in, like, son born of incest on the throne, so, you know, she hasn't done nothing right. But and I thought she brought up a good point, and it's something that Cersei's brought up before, I think, which is that, you know, Jaime got all his stuff because he was the boy and she was the girl, and her job was to marry Robert and have babies. And so it's an echo of that Brienne gender thing from before, where it's like, she says to Tywin, why didn't you confide in me? You know, you confided in Jaime, but you didn't confide in me. And, like, honestly, maybe if he had paid more attention to her, she wouldn't be so problematic. But on the same token, yes, of course, we agree with Tywin that she's not as smart as she thinks she is. And maybe it is good that someone finally has a handle over Joffrey, since she is crap at it. So.
Right, right. As someone who's clearly, as you mentioned, a political genius too, right? And who knows how to manipulate the people and get good results from them, unlike Cersei, right?
Right, manipulate the people and manipulate Joffrey.
Right.
You know, she's like, ooh, show me more dead bodies. This is delightful, you know. So.
That was a good Margaery impression.
Thank you.
There's also this awesome scene out by the garden where Varys encounters the Queen of Flowers, right?
Queen of Thorns.
Queen of Thorns. I apologize.
I love this scene because Olyanna is making fun of the House Tyrell words, which are stupid.
Well, she's breaking the fourth wall, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Right? She's saying, yeah, how winter is coming. That's memorable. And that's hilarious. Whenever a character breaks the fourth wall, and she's so, you know, saucy.
Yes.
It's pretty awesome. And they hatch this plan because Varys is terrified that Baelish is going to get Sansa, because with Sansa at his side, like, he sees no stopping Baelish. So the way to do that is by having Sansa enter a loveless marriage with
Sir Loras.
Sir Loras, that's right. So again, I know you already know how this ends. Can you comment on whether that's a, whether you feel that's a good idea without commenting on how it ends?
Well, so what's funny about this, this has nothing to do with how it ends, is that in the book there's actually like another Tyrell, and he's like a cripple, and that's the one that they engage her to, not the hot gay brother, but the like cripple brother who lives far away. And so like Sansa's way more stoked in the TV show because she's like, Loras, oh, he's got such shiny hair and he gave me a rose that one time. I really like him. Whereas in the book she's like, oh, the cripple brother. Okay. So yeah, it's it is interesting how much Sansa is a chess piece. We talked about this last week, I think. But yeah, like that if Baelish, if Peter Baelish walks off with her, that's a huge, you know, power shift. And then, you know, Varys just wants to keep her away from Baelish. I don't know what, you know, I don't know if they've properly conveyed to you what the Tyrell advantage is to having Sansa do that. Like out of the kindness of their heart or what, like why they would engage her to Loras, but
yeah,
maybe to quash those pesky gay rumors. I don't know.
Yeah. It's, I don't think it's fully conveyed. Well, I think it's not bad. It's certainly not bad for the Queen of Thorns if this union does occur, right? Like it's a good power play for them as well,
I guess,
to be allied with the Starks.
No, you're right. Like it'll protect them from, you know, the Starks can't exactly make war with the Tyrells if their daughter is married to a Tyrell. So right, yeah, it's a right. Good point. Yes.
See, I make good points sometimes.
You always make good points.
Someone wrote in this week and says essentially, Dave, how do you keep track of everything that's going on in the show? I could have sworn he was actually making fun of me. I thought he was being sarcastic, but I think he actually might have been serious. So
I want to say really briefly that I think my favorite part about Diana Riggs, like, breaking the fourth wall and talking about it, she does this like northerner accent. She's like, winter is coming, like, you know, she's like, god, she's such a freaking treat, and I'm so glad they cast her.
She's great.
So,
and then also when she delivers the what happens when the non-existent bumps up against the decrepit.
Yeah, exactly. Come on,
is that line in the book, do you remember? Or
no, I don't know. I don't think it is. I could be wrong. Please do email me if I'm wrong,
because if not, that's brilliant. You know what I mean?
I do.
And the look, here's the thing, the look on Varys' face when she says that is pretty hilarious. Like he like kind of looks down. He's like, oh, which one am I?
He looks like he just wants to disappear into his little kimono. He's like, I don't know what to do here. She's awesome. So,
all right. So the second weak point in this episode, Joanna, we should probably talk about the Theon storyline. Now, in my opinion, and I know you probably can't comment on this, but in my opinion, the Theon storyline has officially jumped the shark. Here's why. So what happens here is the guy who kind of says, oh, I'm helping your sister out, and kind of takes Theon away, and they're in the middle of – and he kind of leads him through this serpentine hallway, and Theon has this amazing moment, this very, very moving moment where he says, you know, my real father's in King's Landing, and he finally – For the first time, is able to fully express his regrets and his feelings. Now, he did say in the, I think, season finale of season two, something along the lines of, or maybe the penultimate episode of season two, something like, I've done a lot of things, like things I never thought I'd do. But this is the episode where I think he's fully kind of expressing remorse and fully identifying with the Stark clan as his true family, which we as the audience, I think, all knew that was the case the whole time, right? But it's just really kind of cathartic to see him say it. Anyway, and then you find out that they're actually leading him back to the start, and the guy was like, who saved him was sent out to go and capture him and killed all the other dudes, and then just went back and was like, yeah, Theon killed everyone and I'm bringing him back, and now Theon's back to where he began. And
so did you think, like, when you were watching it, did you believe that he was working for Yara? Did the whole thing like reek of like some sort of plot twist for you?
It definitely reeked. Like, it didn't feel right to me. But I could see one viewing this plot line as not reeking, though. Like, I could see one viewing it as, oh, that maybe Yara is trying to help him, although Because she did express some affection for him in season two, towards the end of season two, right? So I could see that that being plausible. But what I did not see coming was that he would just be taking him back to the original place. And the reason I feel like this is jumping the shark is because, I don't know, it just is so – it feels really dumb to me. Is I guess the most intelligent way I have of describing it, that it feels like spinning wheels. It feels like, oh, you're doing all this stuff to get Theon back in the storyline, but there's actually nothing really from a plot perspective happening with Theon. So we had him go about this whole circuitous adventure. We had this psychotic dude kill all of Theon's captors and then just bring him back for what? For what? For the pleasure of seeing him have hope and then tortured even more fully. Now, if this guy is going to be a major character and his psychosis, his kind of mental instability is going to become a major plot point, then okay, well done, show. You definitely set that up really well. But if that's not the case, then all you've done is spin the wheels on Theon's storyline without going anywhere. And I feel like that's, you know, you thrilled me. And it just it felt cheap, man. It felt like a one night stand, you know? It was meaningless, but it was thrilling.
So this is okay, so this is like a Joffrey-esque psychotic bastard, you're okay with it, and then if it's like just some rando, you're like what? You feel like it was Danny's plotline last season in Karth, where they're spinning their wheels just to keep a character around.
Correct. Mm-hmm. That is correct. Okay. So we'll see which one it ends up being, but I don't think, and you have refused to comment on this at all, right?
Correct.
That's what's going on. Yeah. Okay. So let me know if you go ahead.
There's nothing. No good can come of me saying anything. So.
Well, were you at least moved by the scene when Theon?
Yeah, I thought Alfie Allen was great in that scene, and I think, I mean, the horror of, I thought it worked really well. From my standpoint, but my standpoint is obviously flavored by whatever my perceptions. But to have him, you know, pour his guts out, be really honest, and then to be confronted by that torture ex. I don't know if there's like a term for the torture ex, but you know, like to have him be confronted by that again, and you know, the terror and the horror. I thought it was gruesome and great, but you know.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm willing to see where it goes. I'm not. My mind and my heart are not completely closed to the Theon storyline quite yet. But
because Theon's like your fave, you love him.
Yeah, he was an awesome character in season two. So I'm still like very open to seeing where it goes. But I lost a lot of faith in the show for that plotline this week. Like that was pretty rough, Joanna. Pretty rough. That's I felt like how Theon felt after seeing that torture X again. It's kind of like, oh man, not only is Theon back to being tortured, but now like what was the last four episodes for? What was all that pointless action for if it was not to advance the storyline in any way? Again, maybe revealing a little bit about that psychotic guard, like that arguably is worthwhile, but
I've had a lot of because I refuse to comment on Era, I get a lot of emails of people asking about my thoughts on the Theon plotline. And once again, I will shamefully plug the spoiler post that I do on Pajiba because I talk about it there. So
all right.
If you care to hear my opinions, that's where you will find them. But not on air, lest Dave cry and get really mad at me. So.
Okay, and two more plot lines to discuss this week. So actually, before we discuss this, can we comment on which plot lines have been left out of this episode, right? So
No Rob Stark
and no Melisandre or Stannis or Davos.
No Jon Snow.
No Jon Snow, right? Good point. No
no real life Catelyn, only dream Catelyn.
That's right. Good point.
Yeah.
No Talisa, you know, because right. I know that the number one character for everyone.
No, they're missing Shay, who's my favorite character.
Oh, yeah, good point. No Shay. Where was Shay, Joanna? Where was Shay? Okay. So two more plot lines. More about the Brotherhood Without Banners, right? The Hound is taken to this cave, which, like, looks amazing. Like, they had these shots from inside the cave, and just, like, you think logistically how to get a film crew into there, you know what I mean? I don't know if it was CGI, but it looked spectacular the way they filmed it. But yeah, actually, you know, Jenna, now that I think of it, this is kind of another weak point in this week's episode.
Mm.
Because you have this reveal of the guy who's kind of the head of the Brotherhood, right? And can you explain who this is?
This is Beric Dondarrion. We met him very briefly in season one, and he was a former knight who Ned Stark sent out to find the Hound's brother.
So there's two things that I thought were kind of – there's a couple of things I thought were worth noting and a little bit puzzling. First of all, we see Arya is really hung up on the death of that butcher's boy, right, from season one.
He was her bestie.
Obviously, it was a traumatic event, like, and it shows how Joffrey and is horrible and how the inhumanity of this world. Like, I get that. But, like, the Hound was just he didn't, like – it was not his fault that that kid died. Do you know what I mean? So, like, she pointed it out last episode, and then also this episode, she brings it up at this trial by combat. You know, like she says, "Oh, it's he killed that boy. Like, that's why you should kill the Hound." All this stuff, and it's like, and the Hound brought up a very rational point, which is, dude, I was just obeying orders, man. Anyone else in his situation probably would have done the same thing. So,
okay, but this is like this is the whole. Two-prong thing. First of all, in my thesis of that the theme of the season...
Your dissertation, yes.
My dissertation on season three of Game of Thrones is that it's all about serving masters and servants and loyalties and that sort of stuff and who you serve and who you obey and why. You know, and that's the Valor Duaris, like the first episode of the season was called that. And so... He has this whole conversation. I actually thought this scene was really interesting. And he has this whole conversation where they're like, all these people died because of the Lannisters. He's like, well, I didn't physically kill those people. So you can't hold me responsible for that. And then Arya's like, well, but you physically killed the butcher's boy. Like you did that. You cut him in half. And he's like, well, who am I to say no to a prince? But he said, I mean, that's just bullshit. The Hound's just talking bullshit because he says no to the prince later. You know what I mean? Like... Honestly, the Hound is talking bullshit to try to get out of it. Arya brings up the butcher's boy, not just because he's her best friend, but because they were having trouble pinning an exact murder on him, you know?
Right, but I feel like it's supposed to be I agree with you that it's you know, he's just BSing his way out of the situation. But I think that, you know, he does have a legit point. Right, that like the moral outrage that Arya feels about the death of the butcher's boy, I think, is misdirected at the Hound.
Well, sure, but he's on her list, like her little death watch list that right. She recites. Like, yeah, he was only the sword, but he was the sword. And even if you're just, you know, obeying orders, you ultimately have to be held responsible for those actions. And the whole Brotherhood Without Banners, like their whole thing, is kind of vigilante justice. Right. Like that's what they do is they go around the countryside and try to right wrongs. And so that's, you know, they're holding the Hound accountable for his actions, even though he was obeying the prince. They don't recognize that. They recognize a different kind of right and wrong. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. That's fair enough, I guess. I mean, you know. It's kind of the analogy of like banality of evil, and I was just obeying orders in World War II Nazi Germany.
Right, you know? Exactly.
I guess.
You know, it's like they're like the group of people who would go to Argentina to hunt down all the Nazis who are in hiding. Who, you know what I mean? Like this is who the Brotherhood Without Banners are. And I don't know that they've done a tremendous job of explaining that. And also, I agree with you that Beric Dondarrion, who we met, the guy with the eye patch, like, they haven't really explained who he is. But I think my guess is that we will learn more next episode. So.
And that's the thing. There's supposed to be this, like, holy crap moment at the end where he's like, you're going to fight me, dun, dun, dun. And I was like, what? Like, why do we care? Do you know, like, we have no idea who this dude is. So
right. Why
would he care that he's fighting the Hound? It's supposed to be this big reveal. And it has no weight to it whatsoever. In the books, do you know more about this character before this scene?
Yes. Right. And all during the scene, because it's Arya's point of view. Arya's sort of thinking about all the things she knows about him.
Right.
So it's filled in. But I really think next episode, it'll put your – I don't know. I don't want to talk too much about it, but
it'll put my mind at ease, hopefully. So I hope you're right, Joanna. I hope you're right. All right. Also, the final and perhaps most spectacular plotline of this episode is the Danny storyline. My, how far we've come from starving in the middle of the desert to buying the Unsullied with her dragon, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I want to point out, I was right, kind of, or I called it, kind of. Namely, that that someone would actually be able to speak Valyrian. Now, I have heard Dany say many times that she is of the blood of Valyria, right?
Right.
Is that what she says? And so, I actually did remember that, but I don't remember it being explicitly said that at Astapor they're speaking Valyrian.
Yeah, and in the book... you know, I like how they played it in the TV show, because in the book, you know from the get-go that she understands everything that's being said around her.
I see, yeah. So, whereas in the book, it's this amazing... I'm sorry, in the show, it's this amazing moment.
Right, exactly. It's pretty badass. They ramped up the badass by doing it that way. And yeah, you could... I think one could suspect that reveal was coming. And one could also... I mean, I think, you know, like, we had a lot of people speculating. We already talked about this. We had a lot of people speculating about what Dany would do with her dragon. You know, and I don't think it's unreasonable to expect that. The way they get around it in the book is because it's inside her head. She's talking a lot about how upset she will be to lose her dragon. So I don't think you really see it coming as much in the book as you do in the TV show, even, because she just talks about... She doesn't reveal her plan, and she just talks about...
She doesn't reveal her plan even in her inner monologue?
Yeah, even in her head. She just talks about how nervous she is and how sad she would be to lose her dragon, you know? Because, like, if things go south, if her plan does not come off, she would lose her dragon. So she just talks about how nervous she is and how much she loves her dragon. So you're like, God, she's just going to leave her freaking dragon there. And then, yeah, and then there's that big reveal of the whole Dracarys thing, so...
So... let me just say, the guy at Astapor, it's kind of like selling a loaded gun to someone for cash. Do you know what I mean? In a back alley, or it's kind of like, what's to stop the guy from just holding you up and taking the money from you? this guy, not a great business plan to sell all the Unsullied and leave yourself entirely defenseless.
Well, he's obviously shown how much he respects Danny's intelligence and right. Women in general. So I'm sure I think he just saw her as a stupid blonde. So,
but it's just like, you would think that if you're going to transfer a huge sum of Unsullied, you'd do so in a way to make sure that they can't turn the Unsullied on you and sack your whole city. You know, it just seems like common sense, man.
It does. I mean, I think you should be the new slave master of Astapor.
I think that's the conclusion. That's the job I'm running for, really, with this podcast. Okay. And also, won't Dany now be seen as a deal welcher, right? Like, she backed out on her promise to give this guy the dragon.
God, her credit is ruined.
Who is ever going to make a deal with Dany again?
Yeah, her credit score is, like, it's crap now. Yeah. So
she turns the army against her. There's that spectacular shot where, like, the dragon, like, blows up all the stuff behind her, and you see, like, the fireballs go up over Dany while Dany has this, like, non-reaction. That's awesome, right? That's amazing. That is amazing filmmaking.
Do you think the Unsullied have nipples on their shields to make up for the fact that occasionally their nipples get sliced off?
I think that's entirely possible.
Okay.
That's entirely possible. Also, during the scene, I was kind of terrified that the Unsullied would kill Barristan Selmy and Mormont. I was like, whoa. Dany, before you tell them to kill everyone, maybe you should make sure that those guys are protected. But upon, you know, I think it all turned out okay, in other words.
Well, I love that, like, Barristan and Jorah give each other, it was like something out of an 80s movie where they're like, that's our girl. Like, such a stamp of approval look to each other. And then, yeah, Jorah is just like, man, you are the hottest thing ever. Like, she is.
I am so turned on right now, is what he wanted to say.
Jorah's, like, mass slaughter really turns me on. I don't know what to tell you about that.
So then she releases all the Unsullied and is like, hey, you're free to go, but if you follow me, you know, you're able to follow me. And I thought that was an amazing moment because I was wondering, how are they going to deal with this? Like, are people just going to start calling out, I am Spartacus, right? Like, what's going to happen?
And it was very I am Spartacus.
Yeah, I mean, they just started banging their spears, and it's like, that's the way That is totally the way I can imagine the Unsullied communicating, right? It's just I'm being totally serious. Like, what? How are you going to handle that scene? And they handle it quite well. So.
Something I think we should mention is that I think people don't give enough credit for is Emilia Clarke, the way that she does the made up foreign languages that she has to speak.
Yeah,
her Dothraki was really good, and her Valyrian is really good. I know they're made up languages, but you know they picked an actress who could do very convincing sounding foreign languages. Like I think she's fantastic.
I don't know, Joanna. I thought her Valyrian had a pretty strong accent, even though it was her mother tongue.
You can really hear the twang. Her like.
I mean, on the one hand, I'm joking, but on the other hand, it's like you're right, Joanna. But really, you can't tell how good she is at them, right?
Well, you can because like. Go watch Liv Tyler try to speak Elven in Lord of the Rings. It's not as awesome as it might be. Whereas with her, like, you don't – I don't know.
I think – isn't it Elvish, Joanna?
Maybe.
It's an Elvish. So don't – got to respect, man. That's all I'm saying. All right. So amazing storyline. So did this – how did this come off?
Someone send us a really detailed email about Tolkien's languages. I beg of you.
Oh, actually, it looks like Elven is a brand of Elvish. So just putting that out there. Okay. So Joanna, what did you think of this scene? How did it come off in your opinion?
Oh, it was awesome. It's a little more violent. Like she did you notice that the whip had like the harpy of Astapor as the handle? She like takes off Krasny's face with that thing. Like she, I don't know why they didn't show that. Maybe it was too violent. I don't know. Like sometimes people make the argument that the book is more sexual and more violent than the show, actually, believe it or not. And in some cases it is. And in this case, like she takes off his face with the like sharp handle of the whip and then his eyeballs melt down his face because of the dragon fire. They didn't show any of that. But nonetheless, it was a supremely badass sequence. I don't think anyone who's been complaining about the first three episodes being like just sort of ramping up and meeting new characters and stuff like that. Like, I feel like everyone has to agree now that the ball is rolling and things are happening. So.
I think the only like kind of downside of this scene is that it really happened very quickly. Like within 5 minutes, she had turned the Unsullied, sacked the whole city, and was leading them out of Astapor in 5 minutes. So.
She's good, is what you're saying.
It just felt really abridged. It felt a bit abridged. I mean, it was amazing, but it was a little bit abridged. I would have liked to see more killing, basically, I think is what I'm trying to say.
It's like 2 pages in the book, so, you know, they could have shown them spearing a bunch of slave masters, like walking around the city with their spears, spearing slave masters and going like, uh-oh, that's a child. She said no children. Okay, next thing, you know,
Did that happen in the book?
That she says no, no.
Oh, okay.
No, but in the book it's weird. In the book, she specifies like no children under 12. But if you turn 12, you're fair game, I guess.
Yeah, that's weird. Also, like, it just feels like this city sacking was kind of on par, not on par, but like, you know, Blackwater. That battle was an entire episode.
You wanted to see a whole episode devoted to the?
No. I'm not saying that.
Slaughter.
I don't know. 5 minutes just felt a little bit short today. I'm picking nits. This is an incredible sequence, an incredible storyline.
I think if it had been any longer, it wouldn't have been as good. I think it was, you know, it's good that it was just like, I mean, it just showed how freaking great she can be. Finally, at last, Daenerys is being badass in the way we want her to be.
Right.
And then we see her marching out with her enormous army and her three fucking dragons high above the air. Like, watch out.
Yeah. She's come a long way, man. A long way. All right, so that concludes our discussion of this week's episode of Game of Thrones. Pretty awesome episode. We have a few emails to read at acastofkings@gmail.com. Feel free to email us. So let's talk about some emails. This email comes in from Bob from Kansas City, Missouri. Bob writes in, "The topic came up about Catelyn being an unpopular character. As a reader of the books, I think Michelle Farley has done a great job of making Catelyn more likable. The primary bone I had to pick with the character in the books was her treatment of Jon Snow. On the TV series, Fairly brings a warmth and humanity to Catelyn that didn't always come across in the books. I would disagree with the comparison to Skyler White, inasmuch as Catelyn has advanced the action every bit as much as her late spouse did, even with her missteps and despite her apprehension with his taking the position of Hand of the King. Everything Catelyn has done has been a service to House Stark, whereas Skyler's action has often been at odds with Walter. I love how, even in a totally unrelated podcast, people still get in digs at Skyler. That's amazing. Let's see. Finally, on the topic of special effects, Kate Dickey, who plays Liza Aaron, was using a prosthetic breast in the scenes where she was nursing her son. Dickey also shows up in the movie Prometheus as Ford, the ship's medical doctor. It's fun to contrast the actress playing both a dignified crew member in a movie and a raving loon in the show.
I don't know that anyone was dignified in Prometheus, first of all. But secondly, we did get a lot of people writing in about that prosthetic breast, and that is a comfort to know.
I guess.
Prosthetic.
I mean, is it better that he was sucking on a prosthetic breast versus a real one?
Slightly.
For her.
Yes. For everyone.
Okay. But yeah, a lot of emails about Catelyn, too, saying that they hated her. And yeah, Tywin brings it up this week, right, Joanna?
Oh yeah, that in that scene with Cersei, Tywin says, what did I do when your brother was Tyrion was kidnapped by Catelyn, and she's like, start a war. He's like, yeah, that's right, I started a war. So that's what Dave and I were debating last week, is what exactly started the war. And of course, there are many things, but Tywin himself said this week that Catelyn's boneheaded maneuver was a major factor. So,
I mean, some people also chimed in that. I think I don't remember who wrote. I think this is at the comments, but someone did chime in that if you go all the way back to the beginning, right? Jaime pushing Bran out of the window. Do you know what I mean?
Bran climbing the tower when he was told he wasn't supposed to.
Yeah, really.
The first time Cersei and Jaime had sex.
Why don't Jaime decided he couldn't keep it in his pants for the entire trip to Winterfell? You know what I mean? Like, what is the proximate cause? If you could go all the way back, there are ways to pin it on people that aren't Catelyn, I think is where we're going with this.
Absolutely. Personally, I think it's Rickon's fault. Let's find a way that it's Rickon's fault.
It's Rickon's fault for being such a useless character.
There you go.
Travis writes in, and please let us know where you're from. Travis from looks like. He is from Coastal Carolina University. Only critique I'd make is on comments of the portions of the discussion that individuals would enjoy to hear in the podcast. In this episode, and by this episode, he means last week's episode, an example would be the discussion of hot pie, specifically on the comment Dave made on not understanding how he became good at making bread. I would have enjoyed Joanna bringing up his past experience at Harrenhal. His experience in making bread came from his work in the kitchens of Harrenhal, even though they didn't have to go into great detail in his experience while in prison there. So, Joanna, shame on you for not bringing up Hot Pie's vast experience with bread making.
See, I mean, that's the thing, guys. That's the thing, listeners, kind listeners, is sometimes I feel like I've reached my quota of, well, in the book, like the number of times I can say that in an episode. So I let the hot pie thing roll by. Yeah, absolutely. Hot pie has... He's honed his
bread baking skills for years at the Harrenhal kitchens.
Not years, but yeah, they were at Harrenhal for a while. And then also he was a baker's boy at King's Landing. So yeah, that's why he's called hot pie. Anyway, that is Hot Pie's backstory. Now we know how he made that amazing wolf cookie that he made.
You deprived us of so much context of this show by not telling us that, Joanna. So I hope you're proud of yourself.
I'm feeling pretty good.
Okay. let's wrap it up. Jenna Robinson, where can I find more of your work on the internet this week?
Well, really quickly before I do that, I did want to a lot of people thanked me for the book recommendation.
Oh, okay. So yeah, let's get to that right at the end. In the meantime, where can we find more work on the internet?
Okay. You can find me everydayonpajiba.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at quityourjrob.
Find me at davechen.net and at twitter.com/davechensky. That's Dave Chen, S-K-Y. You can also find my other podcast that I do at /filmcast.com. All right, Joanna Robinson, what is your book of the week recommendation?
This is a fairly popular series, so most sci-fi fantasy readers probably have read it. But if you're new to the sci-fi fantasy genre, I would recommend Patrick Rothfuss's Kingkiller Chronicles series. So that's Rothfuss, R-O-T-H-F-U-S-S, first name Patrick, the Kingkiller Chronicles, starting with The Name of the Wind. Really, really great fantasy quality.
Thanks, Shoanna, and thank you guys for listening to A Cast of Kings, made possible by SlashFilm.com. We'll see you next week.